Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is syndicated and it airs on other radio stations in different cities in the US and Europe. A quick community update on an upcoming event in Houston, and that is the Palestinian American Cultural Center's annual gala. It will be held on Saturday, September 10th, 2022, under the theme Reclaim, Return, Rebuild. The keynote speaker will be Noura Ariqat, author, human rights attorney, and associate professor at Rutgers University. For more information, visit www.pacchouston.org. On September 5, 2022, Apartheid Israel released a statement on its findings about the assassination of Shireen Abu Aqleh, the Palestinian-American journalist who was murdered by Israel in May 2022. In that statement, Israel said there is a high possibility its army killed Shireen Abu Aqleh, and also said it will not launch a criminal investigation into that killing. I am not surprised at that, and millions around the world are not surprised either by the Israeli finding, because what do you expect from a war criminal and a murderer? Shireen Abu Aqleh's family released a statement saying, quote, "As expected, Israel has refused to take responsibility for murdering Shireen. Our family is not surprised by this outcome since it's obvious to anyone the Israeli war criminals cannot investigate their own crimes. We will continue to demand that the U.S. government follow through with its stated commitments to accountability," unquote. On August 31, 2022, the National Press Club held its annual Journalism Awards dinner and presented Shireen Abu Aqleh's niece, Lina Abu Aqleh, with the 2022 National Press Club President's Award in her honor. Let's listen to the remarks of Lina Abu Aqleh delivered at that awards ceremony.
"I would like to thank the National Press Club for honoring Shireen's legacy with the President Award from this renowned establishment. Shireen has been recognized around the world for her dedication and professionalism. Honoring Shireen with this prestigious award is recognition of Shireen's professional work that will set an example for future generations of journalists. I wish Shireen had been here to receive this herself. Unfortunately, we lost her too soon. It is sad that Shireen was killed by an Israeli sniper while doing her job as a journalist. It is an honor for me to receive this award on her behalf of my aunt, who was my best friend and my role model and my source of inspiration. I'm also very glad that Shireen's Al Jazeera family is present among us. Thank you for all that you've been doing to support our family. And I'm so glad to say that Shireen's childhood best friend, Aline, accompanied by her husband, Philip, is also present among us tonight. It has almost been 4 months now since Shireen was killed, but no official action has been taken so far to hold the perpetrators accountable. My family and I are grateful to the support for Shireen, to the support we've received from organizations and people who are helping us to keep our demands alive. Justice for Shireen is linked to justice for Palestinians. As a family, we have expected at least from the U.S. administration to take a meaningful action for bringing justice to Shireen as a U.S. citizen and also as a journalist. We have expected from the U.S. president to take the case seriously, as in similar cases. But we will never relent. We will bring justice for Shireen. Thank you all for joining us for our support. Thank you."
That was Lina Abu Aqleh, Shireen Abu Aqleh's niece, speaking at the annual National Press Club Journalism Awards dinner. 29 years ago this month, the Oslo Accord was signed between the Palestine Liberation Organization and Israel. An accord that at that time some thought was a good idea and others did not. In 2018, on the 25th anniversary of the signing of the Oslo Accord, I interviewed Diana Bhutto, analyst and former legal advisor to Mahmoud Abbas, chairman of the Palestine Liberation Organization, who also served as legal advisor to the PLO in its negotiations with Israel. Let's listen in to that interview. Joining us from Palestine is Diana Bhutto. She's an analyst, former legal advisor to Mahmoud Abbas, chairman of the Palestine Liberation Organization, who also served as legal advisor to the PLO in its negotiations with Israel. She is a lawyer specializing in negotiations, international law, and international human rights law. She is based in Palestine and is also a policy advisor to Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. Diana, welcome to Arab Voices.
Thank you. Thank you, Saeed. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. It's great to have you again on the show. This particular month marks the 25th anniversary of the Oslo Accord that was signed between the Palestine Liberation Organization and Israel. If you could take us back to that date, please. You used to advise the Palestinians, the PLO, and you were for the Oslo Accord at that time. Tell us and our listeners, please, the main points of what Oslo was supposed to do for the Palestinians and why they signed on.
That's a great question. So I should make clear, I wasn't the person who had advised them to sign on to Oslo. I was far too young for that. But I was somebody who was in my teen years at the time, somebody who thought that, the way that many people thought, that Oslo was actually going to bring about peace. So I was mistaken in the belief, in large part because I believed the newspaper accounts. I believed what I had been told and what I was listening to. I believed that Oslo was actually going to lead to Palestinian liberation. I didn't believe the critics, such as Edward Said and others, who said that Oslo was actually going to lead to further subjugation. So in the minds of what I think the Palestinian leadership at the time who signed on to Oslo, what I think that they thought that they were getting out of it is something very different than what was actually on paper. So what I think that they thought that they were getting out of it was that within 5 years, and there's a reason that they believed five years, it's because it's spelled out in the 1994 agreement, they believed that in 5 years, Palestinians would be free. And they believed that within those 5 years, more and more Palestinian territory would be transferred from the Israeli army to the Palestinian Authority. They believed that settlement activity was going to stop. And they believed that that at the end of a five-year period, there was going to be freedom. Now, what ended up happening was exactly the opposite. And I'm not somebody who believes that this was just a question of poor implementation of Oslo. It was exactly what Oslo was meant to do,
which is to continue the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories, the expansion of the colonies, and so on and so on and so on. But all of that was not realized at that time by the PLO?
No, it wasn't. And there were reasons that it wasn't realized. First, because I think it's important to keep in mind that at the time, the PLO was under intense pressure. This is a PLO that had come out at the end of the Gulf War and had been supporting Saddam Hussein. International support for the PLO was at an all-time low. At the same time, I think that they were also afraid of losing, their name as being the Palestinian leadership. And because the Intifada was taking place here in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. And other things is, I think also that there was a lot of deception. I can tell you in terms of some of the deceptive things that had been iterated to me when it came to settlements, is that that there had been an agreement, a private agreement between Rabin and between Arafat, that there wouldn't be a construction of settlements. And the reason that Rabin said to Arafat that he couldn't include it in the text itself was because then he knew that his coalition would never push through or sign on to Oslo. And, you know, it's these types of things of in part being deceived, in part wanting to be deceived, and in part wanting to be relevant, that is what the hallmark of Oslo was. I think the big problem, however, is that on a certain level, much of the leadership believed that even though they were signing on to this flawed agreement, that at least the international community was going to step in and do something. But what we've seen for the past 25 years is exactly the opposite, that the international community has completely stepped away and removed its hands. So while they definitely signed on to a bad agreement, some of them understanding it, many of them not, I do think that one central element that they all believed was that the international community was going to do something, and it turns out that they did absolutely nothing.
And even when Israel signed on the agreement, I mean, obviously actions on the ground speak louder than words, they really never intended for it to lead to Palestinian freedom at the end of that agreement or during the negotiations because, and I'm sure you've heard this before, many years ago, Benjamin Netanyahu was quoted, or he was actually caught on tape speaking in Hebrew in a settler's house, that they really were working on foiling the Oslo Accord and not to implement it to begin with.
Yes, and even beyond that, you don't even have to listen to the words of Netanyahu. You can even listen to the words of the architect himself, which was Yitzhak Rabin. Yitzhak Rabin, 1 month before he was, 1 month before he was assassinated in 1995, so this would have been in October of 1995, he appeared before the Knesset, and in his statement before the Knesset, he stood up and he said, look, Oslo is going to make sure that the Palestinians never get a state. They're going to have something, but it will never be a state. So this is only 2 years after the signing of Oslo. So it was very clear from the beginning in the minds of the Israeli negotiators exactly what it is that they intended to do. And it was also very clear in the minds of the Israeli opposition that they were going to make sure that that they would use this opportunity to build and expand more and more Israeli settlements.
So it was clear almost from the beginning or right after that you have said it yourself, you've made a mistake. Initially, you were for it because many people believed in it, that it would lead to real peace, freedom maybe for the Palestinians, end of the brutal military occupation. But shortly after that, actions on the ground were very clear that Israel had no true intention of that. So that was not realized by the Palestinian leadership at that time, or they were continuing to gamble because they had no other option whatsoever but to hope that Israel might move towards peace?
I think that it's hard. Look, I didn't work for them at the time, so I can't put myself in their mindset. I can tell you in general what I've seen over the years. The big thing that I believe a lot of the leadership was thinking was that it was going to lead to freedom. And more importantly, and this is the part that I keep stressing, is that they actually believed that the international community was going to do something. And this wasn't, by the way, this isn't a blind belief. As much as I dislike the leadership and am very critical of Oslo and am very critical of all of the things that they've done over the course of the past 25 years, I think we also have to be somewhat fair in asking the question, why did they sign on to this? And there were a lot of people who were bolstering them and who were saying to them that they would be standing shoulder to shoulder with Palestine. And we ended up seeing that they didn't. So, for example, the minute that Oslo was signed, we began to see from 1993 onward the fastest rate of settlement growth in Israel's history. From 1993 until the year 2000, the settler population doubled. Now, we can't blame the Palestinian leadership for the settler population doubling. We can blame those who make the settler population double, which is Israel. We can also blame those who allow it to double without any consequence, and that would be the international community. It's inconceivable that you know, Palestinians who, by and large, if you look at the opinion polls at the time, were also very supportive of Oslo. It's inconceivable that these people would have supported a process that was leading to more and more settlements, more and more checkpoints, and so on. But this is what we had, and there was the ability to stop this process, whether it's the Israeli government or the international community. But both of them chose not to do so. And in fact, like when you look back at Oslo, the big turning point in terms of where Israel was heading happened in February 1994 when Baruch Goldstein went into the Haram al-Brahimi, the Brahimi Mosque in Hebron during Ramadan as people were praying at the Fajr prayers and gunned down Palestinians, with the aftermath being that there was closure imposed on Palestinians, checkpoints put up in front of the Haram, and rather than Rabin evacuating those settlers, and he certainly had the opportunity to do so, and he had the support to do so, he instead doubled down and made sure that there were more settlers that were brought in and that Palestinians paid the price. Again, these are the things that that ended up being the real awakening points for people, including the Palestinian leadership. And the issue that I cannot stress enough is that it was that Israel was allowed to do whatever it wanted to do because suddenly we were in this framework of negotiations, and the international community didn't want to impose sanctions.
Now, you've mentioned the Israeli settlements or colonies, and you've said that between 1993, when the Oslo Accord was signed, and 2000, the population of the Israeli settlers doubled in size, and up to this date, I believe that has tripled to almost 700,000 Israeli settlers living. And when we talk about settlements and colonies for our listeners, and I would like to hear more from you about them, we are talking about colonies inside whatever is left of Palestine, inside the occupied West Bank, inside occupied East Jerusalem, not inside Israel itself, where they are building more and more areas for themselves, correct?
Yes. So in terms of the numbers, you're correct, it's close to 700,000, which is more than triple. On the eve of the signing of Oslo in 1993, it was a little under 200,000. And now we're looking at close to 700,000. Some even project a little bit beyond 700,000. And yes, we're talking about only those settlements that are in the West Bank and in, which includes East Jerusalem, and in the Gaza Strip. And the reason that I'm only focused on those two areas is because that's the area that is specified in the Oslo agreements itself. It's not my own personal belief or designation.
And we hear it all the time. As a matter of fact, just yesterday or a couple of days, Israel seized another Palestinian land for what they call settlement expansion. Tell us more about that, because that is truly ongoing. They continue to demolish Palestinian homes. They continue to kick Palestinians out, seize their property for settlement expansion. And then they build more roads and they take more land to secure the roads that only Israelis can use to reach, to go in and out of those Israeli colonies.
Yes, it's like cancer. I mean, if you liken it to a disease, which it is, it's like cancer. So it starts off with one small area, and then it suddenly expands because now they need to have houses for the other families, and then they need to have playgrounds, and then they need to develop schools, and then they need shopping. Who doesn't do shopping? And then they need roads to connect that settlement to another settlement, and then they need, in addition to that road, they then need a security perimeter road, and next thing you know, it's spread and spread and spread and spread throughout the West Bank. This is why it's not at all surprising that what Israel talks about in terms of the West Bank land is 60% of that land is land that's either with settlers on it or zoned for settlements. And so the amount of land that Israel keeps taking is expanding and expanding and expanding. Now, in the process, anything that comes in the way of these expansion plans are things that suddenly get demolished, which is what we're seeing now with the community in Khan al-Ahmar in around the Jerusalem area. What we also see in other areas in the south, Qusais Sousia, where what the Israelis are intending to do is build and expand settlements, connect those settlements to one another, and then connect those settlements into larger Israeli cities.
You know, when we look at what is happening now in Khan al-Ahmar, as you mentioned, it's a Palestinian, it's a very small Palestinian village in the Jerusalem governorate, and Israel is kicking out Palestinians from their own land, as you mentioned, to build, to expand settlements and connect settlements together. I mean, we are witnessing what happened in 1948, 70 years ago. Today, it is ongoing, and it is truly ethnic cleansing of Palestine.
Yes.
Tell us more about Khan al-Ahmar. That is really horrific. I mean, what we are watching now in front of our eyes, the international community, is unimaginable now.
Yes, and Saeed, this is your point regarding the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. We've been in a process of ethnic cleansing since 1948. It's not, there hasn't been one specific like end period. So 1948 was the big ethnic cleansing, and then since that time, there's been these slow measures of ethnic cleansing, as some of my friends put it, death by a thousand cuts. And Khan al-Ahmar is exactly one of those examples. So the community of Khan al-Ahmar, it's a very small community. It's a very lovely community. It's about 200 people who are originally from the Naqab and were expelled from their land in the Naqab in 1952. And then in 1952 made their way up from Naqab to the Negev, to the Jerusalem periphery, to the Jerusalem area. So they're about 8 kilometers, about 5 miles outside of Jerusalem itself. And they have been situated on the land of Khan al-Ahmar since 1952. They chose that spot because it's between two water sources. And this is a largely grazing community. It's a farming and grazing community. They sought permission from the owners of the land in Anata, who gave them permission to stay there. And they've been there longer than the settlements that are nearby. In 1986, Israel then built two settlements nearby on the hills. One is a settlement called Mishor Adumim, and the other one is Ma'ali Adumim, which is a little bit further to the west. And these two settlements have been expanding ever since and have been trying to squeeze out Khan al-Ahmar. The sad part of the story, the sad and both tragic part of the story, is that as the community grew, they also wanted to make sure that their kids would be able to access education. And what Israel did was, where Khan al-Ahmar is situated, they built a huge highway and rerouted it twice to get even closer to the community. When they did that, you see the irony that they now labeled Khan al-Ahmar as being a security threat because it's so close to a major highway. And when these people decided that they wanted to build a school for their kids, they decided to go the legal route, which is what a lot of Palestinians very erroneously do. They applied for a permit in what is oddly termed the civil administration, and there's nothing civil about it. It's actually a group of army and settlers. And like 99% of applications, their application to build a school was denied on security grounds. So the community decided to take matters into their own hands, and they said, "We're going to go ahead and build this school." And we're not going to do it out of concrete. We're going to do it out of the most simple mechanisms and tools available, which is used tires and mud. So today you see this very simple school that's made out of mud brick and tires that's sitting on a hill. And because Israel views any structure as being illegal, including a tent, suddenly, this school found itself with a demolition order, facing a demolition order. And that's been the story of Khan al-Ahmar. I mean, who demolishes a school? I'm constantly trying to get my head wrapped around this idea that it's okay to demolish schools. Unfortunately, I'm not depraved enough to think that it is okay to demolish a school. But this is where we are when it comes to Khan al-Ahmar. So we're now at a point where the Israeli government has declared not only that the school is to be demolished, but that the entire community is to be demolished for, sometimes they say it's for quote-unquote security reasons. Other times they say that it's for because the community doesn't have building permits that were denied to them. Yet that same logic doesn't seem to be applied to Israeli settlements when they build illegally, when Israeli settlers pose a threat to Palestinian lives. All that they are intent on doing is going after the most marginal community in Palestine with the depraved mind of Lieberman, Israel's minister, one of Israel's ministers, tweeting with glee about how happy he is that this community is going to be demolished.
What is being done from the Palestinian side other than the Palestinians themselves, the people who live there and surrounding areas? They have been protesting, they have been going there on almost daily basis, even in some international volunteers and supporters, they've been there, but these are all on a personal level. On the Palestinian side, the leadership side, the Palestinian Authority or the PLO or the international arena, has there been any flags raised? Has there been any action taken to try to stop this ethnic cleansing of Khan al-Ahmar and others?
Yes. And, you know, this is a, I have to say, when in some days where we are very down here in Palestine, and there's a lot of those days, Khan al-Ahmar is definitely one of those places that gives you hope. And the reason that it gives you hope is that you look at this tiny little community of about 200 people and living in the most basic of conditions, most of them in just very rudimentary tents. And the fact that this community has managed to garner international support just speaks to the resilience and the power that Palestinians have. So yes, there are. There's everything from round-the-clock solidarity activists who are there, including sleeping there every night. There have been people who've been pushing for this community, and we've seen the European Parliament issue a resolution condemning Israel and demanding that it not demolish. We've seen Bernie Sanders speak out about it. We've seen Dianne Feinstein also speak out and tweet about it as well. There have been a number of European countries, who have urged the government not to demolish and are pressing the government not to demolish. There's others who are saying that Israel will be committing war crimes and are highlighting to Israel that they'll be demanding compensation. The Palestinian leadership has also been there and has also been there in terms of providing support for the school and making sure that the school is still able to run. This has been one of those examples where you see the best in humanity confronting some of the worst and most heinous crimes that are about to happen. So on that, there definitely has been solidarity. Is it enough? Absolutely not. Because at any moment, the community will be demolished. They've tried everything in terms of legally. And the only thing that seems to be keeping this community alive is this international and diplomatic pressure. My fear is that it's going to subside and subside very quickly because the legal measures have run their course. And this is where support is absolutely vital and needed. Israel needs to be given the message loud and clear that what they're doing is going to be committing war crimes and that they should be held accountable for those war crimes. So the statements that the Europeans are giving are good and strong, but they need to be stronger. And the statements that the U.S. is making are good, but they need to be stronger. And Israel needs to be shown that they that they will be held accountable for everything that they're doing.
And so far, they haven't been caring much at all about the international community and what it says, let alone the U.S. And we'll talk about the U.S. and the measures against the Palestinians shortly in more details. But Diana, we've talked about the Israeli colonies, which is a huge, huge obstacle. It's not an obstacle. It's one of the main problems, catastrophes in Palestine, because it is, we're talking about all those colonies, that is only on 22 or whatever is left of the 22% of historic Palestine in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. And that is just one. There are so many things. You live there. You're joining us from there now. You've been there for so many years. But the list that Israel does on daily basis against the Palestinian, part of its ethnic cleansing of Palestine, is humongous, from extrajudicial executions, murder, killing, almost on daily basis, not just in the Gaza Strip, but also in the West Bank. They pass so many laws that discriminate against Palestinians. Military checkpoints, that's something that would like to hear from you, because, you know, sometimes I talk to friends and people here, military checkpoint, they think like in the U.S., oh, the police, they have a roadblock kind of to make sure you're okay, and they check your license, and you go. They don't realize that people, women, pregnant women, people going to schools, work, hospitals, they are being subjected to humiliation, and they stand at the military checkpoint for countless hours to move from one area to another.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's so difficult when discussing Palestine, which issue do you focus on, which only issues do you focus on? And as you very, very eloquently put it, there are so many issues. So on the issue of checkpoints, where do I begin? There's some 500 obstacles that are in place in the West Bank, just hindering transportation and travel, even within the West Bank. So these are people who are being blocked even within their own space, going from one town to the other town, with Israeli obstacles, sometimes checkpoints, sometimes roadblocks set up in their way. But checkpoints themselves, it's one of those issues that is, unless you see it, it's very difficult to describe. I can tell you what it's been like for me living here. I've been living here for quite some time, having to maneuver checkpoints, which is, you think about them, they're part of your every single day calculation. You waste so much energy and time thinking about what's going to be the easiest way to get in and to get out. Because what you don't want is, you don't want to be stuck in sometimes 2, 3, 4, 5 hour long checkpoints. And you certainly don't want to be subjected to the endless rounds of questioning and humiliation that you face at the checkpoints. And by the way, I want to make it clear, those who are allowed to pass the checkpoints are the very privileged few. There are thousands of Palestinians, fewer than 10% of Palestinians are even able to get near a checkpoint because they're barred from travel. So, you know, you're talking about people who are under the age of 25, who live a few kilometers away, a few miles away from the sea, who've never been able to see the sea. Or Palestinians in Gaza who've never been able to leave the Gaza Strip to get a permit to come to the West Bank, to visit Jerusalem, to go see Nazareth. This is what our life has been confined to, is this constant thinking about, how do I move around? Which way do I go? Am I going to be facing a body search? Am I going to be able, if you're somebody who is not able-bodied, to go be able to fit through the turnstiles? Am I going to be crushed standing in line along the way because there are thousands of people who are trying to cross? And sadly, this is the reality for people living here on a day-to-day basis, who go to work, go to school, or are trying to get medical treatment. They're constantly subjected to these checkpoints. As I said, I don't know which issue to highlight and which one not to highlight, because it's all so important, and it all affects the way that we live our lives daily, and the daily denial of freedom. And as I said, it's death by a thousand cuts.
And also, Diana, I want to ask you about the Israeli apartheid wall that it started to erect several years ago, cutting through Palestinian villages and towns, basically grabbing more land and destroying Palestinian homes and families as it cuts through them. Is that still ongoing? Does Israel, is it continuing to expand and build that apartheid wall?
Yes, yes, absolutely. It's in parts, it's in particular in the south of Bethlehem, the wall is continuing to be built. But in other parts where it's not continuing to be built, they've in parts put it on hold. The same regime is still in place, which is that of having either a 25-foot high concrete wall or series of different barbed wire fences along the way, or a series of obstacles that you simply can't go around. So yes, this is continuing. What's important, and this is where I go back to the international community, there was a court decision that came out by the International Court of Justice in the year 2004. And the International Court of Justice said to Israel that it has to dismantle its wall, but it also said to third parties, to the international community, that they shouldn't be dealing with Israel and with this apartheid wall. In other words, that they shouldn't be doing anything that is going to be either facilitating it or recognizing it or supporting it in any way. And yet what we've seen is that since this decision came out, which was in 2004, we're now in 2018, and the international community has done absolutely nothing.
And as you mentioned, gosh, there are so many points we want to talk about. So we are fortunate to be speaking with you to tell us and our listeners the reality on the ground in occupied Palestine. Gaza Strip, Israel withdrew its forces, quote unquote, several years ago. We know it continues to strangulate the Gaza Strip. Some describe it as the largest open-air prison in the world. People are dying there. They are being killed almost on daily basis also inside the Gaza Strip by the Israeli occupation forces. We are witnessing wars after wars, war crimes committed on the Gaza Strip, one of the most densely populated areas on this planet. Nearly 2 million people live there. Tell us more about what's happening in the Gaza Strip.
The Gaza Strip is a place that's very near and dear to my heart because I lived there for some time. I lived there during the period that the Israelis were dismantling their settlements. They never pulled out. They were just dismantling the settlements, and the settlers were leaving, but the army, of course, stayed. And during that period, I remember very well what it was like to live under siege. I remember seeing the constant shortages of food, whether it was dairy products or bread or medicines. I remember people standing in line just trying to get bread. And this is, by Israel, it's a man-made disaster. This is exactly what they wanted it. Now, I lived there before all of the bombing campaigns happened. The bombing campaigns happened, the first in 2008, 2009, the next in 2011, 2012, and then the most devastating one was in 2014, when Israel maintained its bombing campaign for over a month and killed more than 2,000 Palestinians. Since that time, the Gaza Strip has never really been rebuilt. So everything from them not having proper water supplies, in fact, most of the water, 90% of the water, close to 95% of the water, is not drinkable. At the time that I lived there, I remember how undrinkable the water was, to the point where when a person bathed, I would remember seeing my hair fall out in clumps from the dirty water. Today, a child in Gaza who is 11 years old has never seen 24 hours of electricity. They've lived their entire life without functioning electricity. And this is because Israel does not allow the power transformer that's in place there to be rebuilt, and certainly doesn't allow enough fuel supplies into Gaza to keep it running, to keep the main transformer running. And so we've seen that the quality of life in Gaza has not only deteriorated, but is bordering, in the words of the UN, on a man-made catastrophe, with hospitals unable to function, basic 80% of the population living off of some donation or another, people very food insecure, children sadly being able to distinguish between different types of artillery that are being used against them. And as I mentioned earlier, with people unable to travel. Now add to this that for 25 Fridays in a row, since the end of March, the Palestinians have been marching towards the electrified fence that separates Gaza, demanding their freedom. And in that period, more than 180 Palestinians have been deliberately gunned down. And I say deliberately because every Israeli soldier has a choice that it can make. They know that these people pose absolutely no threat to them because they are both behind an electrified fence and there's a buffer zone between them and the soldier. And yet Israeli soldiers have built dirt mounds to be able to deliberately shoot down into the Gaza Strip, kill Palestinians who are protesting. We've seen thousands of injuries, close to 4,000 injuries where people are needing amputations. And the hospitals in Gaza are unable to cope with this. And it's not just hospitals in Gaza. In fact, the ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross, said that there isn't a hospital in the world that would be able to cope with this number of people who are being injured with these particular injuries that they are coming in with, which is injuries that end up leading to amputations. If this isn't a cry for our morality and for people to speak up and to recognize what's happening and to stand in support and be pushing for their freedom, I don't know what is. This is the cry of our time when you see that for 25 Fridays in a row, people have been going out just demanding their freedom and getting gunned down. I really don't know what will move people any longer. I want to just raise one more issue side when it comes to the issue of health that I think people are not really fully aware of when it comes to Gaza, which is that in the Gaza Strip, there aren't any cancer treatment facilities, and there's certain types of radiation therapy, certain types of chemotherapy that Israel won't allow to be brought into Gaza. The reason that there aren't any radiation therapy places, by the way, is because Israel won't allow them for quote unquote security reasons. So people with cancer inevitably have to exit the Gaza Strip to be treated in hospitals, either in Jerusalem, in fact, there aren't any West Bank hospitals that have radiation therapy either, for the same reason, or to be treated in an Israeli hospital where Palestinians pay. This is not Israel being footing the bill. This is Palestinians paying. And yet, since the beginning of the year, what Israel has done is they've said that they are now going to hold people who have cancer, particularly women, hostage. And they're not letting these people exit to go get cancer treatment. What they've said is that if the patient or any member of the patient's extended family is in any way linked to Hamas, then they're not going to give them an exit permit. This is in effect using health as a political tool and people who are in desperate need for medical treatment as a political tool and holding them hostage. And it's repugnant. This is again one of those issues that the world should be pushing back against Israel and demanding that people be given access to the medical treatment that they need and not be held hostage.
This is truly shocking. When somebody ill has cancer needing desperate treatment to go to a hospital, Israel would look into the background of that person, and if he or she or their relative is linked to Hamas in some way, they would deny that person's medical treatment?
Absolutely. This is how depraved it's become.
It's like you mentioned it before, it's ongoing ethnic cleansing of Palestine at various level, at various forms. They just don't want Palestinians to live there. I want to talk with you about the United States and where it stands. And I want to start with East Jerusalem, occupied Jerusalem. It is another main focal point that was supposed to have been resolved and discussed and during the Oslo Accord and end up with Jerusalem as the capital of Palestine. But of course, that is not the case. And Israel has actually certain measures against Palestinians in Jerusalem, home demolitions. They confiscate the Jerusalemites' IDs from the Palestinians there. They don't want them to live there. The United States, under the Trump administration, decided to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. That has really bluntly, which is not a surprise to many, basically a slap in the face to the Palestinians. Although many experts say, you know, what is the difference? The U.S. was never an honest broker anyway. The U.S. has always supported Israel anyway. But over the last several months under the Trump administration, the United States cut its funding to UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinians, especially for refugees in the Gaza Strip, in the West Bank, in Jordan, in Lebanon, in so many areas. It provides education, assistance for education. It opens schools, clinics, food, and so on for the Palestinian refugees. The U.S. cuts its funding for the Palestinian Authority. It cuts its funding to Palestinian hospitals in East Jerusalem. You mentioned the Palestinian hospitals in Jerusalem a few minutes ago. The U.S. decided to cut its funding for that. Its ambassador in Israel supports colonial expansion in the Palestinian areas. They just shut down the PLO office in Washington. They are taking all these measures very recent. What do you think of this U.S. stance towards Palestine and Israel?
I think it's important to keep in mind where all of this is coming from. Now, this is Israel's dream list and their wish list. And what the Trump administration has been doing, the Trump regime, is they've been ticking off one by one all of Israel's wish list, all of the items on Israel's wish list. And it's clear. So Israel long ago demanded that the world recognize Jerusalem as its capital. There was a reason that the United States didn't do that. It wasn't because of negotiations. It was because this violates a very basic principle of international law, which is that you can't acquire territory by force and that the world won't recognize acquiring territory by force. So what they've said, what has happened under this Trump regime is that they've not only opened themselves up to rewarding Israel, but this sends a message to everybody around the world that might is right. The only reason that our world order, that we don't have countries invading other countries all the time, is because there is a system of laws that we have to abide by. And what Trump is doing is Trump is saying, who cares about this system of laws? Who cares about hundreds of years of international law? Who cares about 70 years of a U.S. Position? I am better than that. And my re-election is more important than that. And that's the reason that he's doing it. So his first measure was, as you said, to move the embassy. The second measure is that Israel, a long time ago, been demanding that cuts be made to UNRWA. They did this as far back as the late 90s and then all throughout 2000 when they started to put immense pressure on UNRWA, and then most recently under Netanyahu. So it's not at all surprising that this cut came, particularly at the time that it came. And then, of course, you get down into the most basic and the cruel, which is cutting funds to UNRWA. UNRWA is an agency that provides education services, that provides medical support, that has hospitals running, and gives out food supplies. The Palestinians don't want to remain refugees. We want to go home. And yet what Trump is doing is he's punishing refugees. He's taking out his cruelty on, again, the most marginal, the people who are the most marginalized in community, the people who need the most protection are the ones that he's cracking down on. That coupled with the cuts to the hospitals in East Jerusalem, and these are hospitals that really carry the bulk of providing medical assistance to Palestinians in the West Bank and in, in Jerusalem. It's just plain cruel. But what it shows you is that this administration is hand in hand, shoulder to shoulder with a very right-wing version, right, with this very right-wing government that's in place here, a right-wing government that openly talks about ethnic cleansing, a right-wing government that just passed a law that enshrines Jewish supremacy into law. It's a right-wing government that is racist, and Trump has made them his number one wish list. It's not surprising that there are more people in Israel who support Trump than there are in the United States who support Trump.
I guess what Trump has been saying all along, that he has been working on the quote-unquote deal of the century. His deal of the century is to go through the Israel's wish list or dream list to accomplish it and go ahead and check one after the other. And that is the deal of the century in his mind. It's not deal of century for the benefit of the Palestinians.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And make no mistake, there was no need for him to move the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Yes, there had been a law that was passed during the Clinton era saying that it should be moved, but every president, including Bush, refused to move it. And there was no reason for Trump to do this other than to say to Israel, I am your biggest fan. I'm your man in the White House. And he's just going to simply go down Israel's wish list and tick off one item after the other. I think it's important also to keep in mind, Syed, who the people are who Trump has appointed as being the people who are preparing the deal of the century. You have Jared Kushner, who has close family ties to the Netanyahu family, who his family itself has been very supportive of the settlement. You have David Friedman, who's been a financier and backer of the settlements, who called people like J Street, and J Street is hardly a pro-Palestinian organization. He called the people of J Street as being worse than the capos, worse than the people who supported the Nazi regime. And he surrounded himself with these people who are ideologically supportive of Israel's settlement. So it's not at all surprising to me that these are the positions that he is taking. What was surprising to me is that the Palestinian Authority, when Trump was first elected, welcomed his election. And when he came here, greeted him very warmly. What they should have been doing instead was preparing an alternative strategy than this simple, silly strategy that they've stuck to for 25 years, which is that of negotiations. We've seen that negotiations have failed. They will continue to fail. And the fact that this leadership stuck by it, even in the face of somebody like Trump, tells you a lot about how failed a leadership this is.
And despite all of that, the U.S. closed the Palestine Liberation Office in Washington a couple of weeks ago, and they also asked the family of the Palestinian representative there to even leave the country immediately. So they don't even want to talk. They don't even want to see Palestinians. It's Israel's wish list being fulfilled
once again. Absolutely.
So 25 years, clearly a failed Oslo Accord. You've recognized it a few years into it. So many other experts have recognized it. This is nothing but a catastrophe in the making for the Palestinians. It's a waste of time while Israel on the ground continues to do what we just talked about. Where do we go from here? What options do the Palestinians have?
This is a great question, Syed. Look, I think there's a lot of options. And I think we make a mistake if we just keep saying that there's nothing else and everything's been exhausted. It hasn't. I think what we really need to do is we need to focus on holding Israel accountable. Because at the end of the day, Israel's only going to end its actions when it's forced to end its actions. They said as much to us, to our faces, when we were in negotiations and outside of negotiations. They've said it as much. This is why I think it's very important for people to be focusing on pushing and promoting BDS, boycotts, divestment, sanctions, redoubling our efforts, making sure that Israel is held to account for its ongoing human rights violations, for its ongoing colonization, for its ongoing land theft, etc. If we don't do that, then we're going to continue to see more of the same. What we also need to do is we need to put our house in order. And by putting our house in order, what I mean to say is that we haven't had elections in the Palestinian leadership for a very, very, very long time. We haven't had any parliamentary elections, any presidential elections. We haven't had elections within the PLO since 1996. We're in desperate need of new leadership. We're in desperate need of new ideas. We're in desperate need of Hamas and Fatah coming together rather than staying apart. So we really do need to get our internal house in order, because this divide and conquer strategy is something that Israel thrives off of. And the reason that they've been pushing for there to be division and no new leadership is because Israel becomes the primary benefactor of having a split. So I think that we need to really, at this point in time, focus on fixing things internally, while at the same time continuing to push for BDS. I think I want you to put it in and to think of it in a little bit of a different way. I often ask my friends who are in South Africa what life was like in the early 80s, let's say 1982, 12 years before liberation. And they paint a very bleak picture of division, of a lot of violence, of not really seeing where things were going, of a very difficult and rough life. And none of them would have been able to predict that 12 years later that they would be seeing Nelson Mandela freed, and that there is a black president who's leading a non-apartheid South Africa. And I think that that's where we have to really focus our energy, is that if you think back to between the period of 64 and 74, the number of accomplishments that we had as Palestinians were enormous and great, and we can get that back and keep pushing for that if we focus on rebuilding, and if we focus on keeping our eyes on the goal, which is the liberation of Palestine. If we veer and start focusing on governance and who's going to be the head of which ministry or that ministry or whatever, we will always be lost. But if we keep our eyes on the liberation of Palestine by holding Israel accountable, I do believe that we will see freedom.
Very well. We want to thank our guest very much, Diana Bhutu, an analyst, former legal advisor to Mahmoud Abbas, chairman of the Palestine Liberation Organization. She also served as legal advisor to the PLO in its negotiations with Israel. She has been speaking with us from Palestine. Diana, we greatly appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Saeed, for your time as well. And thanks to your listeners for listening.
Thank you so much.
What you just heard was an interview I conducted in 2018 on the 25th anniversary of the signing of the Oslo Accord between the Palestine Liberation Organization and Israel. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.